we're gonna have the St. Petersburg Economic Forum in Russia. And at the same time, we know the other forum is the World Economic Forum in Davos. How do you see the plurality of the people of the countries who are participating in St. Petersburg Economic Forum comparing to the plurality and what we have been witnessing for such a long time in the World Economic Forum?
Well, we have a picture of the division of the world, basically. I mean, the World Economic Forum, historically, is basically the celebration of the West. This is the celebration of the Western economy. It used to be the meeting point for most prominent industry leaders, and it was an opportunity, in fact, given to the economic leaders to meet with political leaders. That's the fundament of the World Economic Forum. I have several friends in Switzerland who are heading companies and manufacturing companies, and they go to the World Economic Forum because it's a fantastic opportunity to get in direct touch with politicians, I mean Western politicians, of course, and with other competitors, in fact. So basically, the World Economic Forum was, and that's the name it has, basically. It's a World Economic Forum, meaning that we are at the center, at the heart of the European, or not the European, the Western economic mechanism, apparatus, or whatever you want. So therefore, when we see who is attending, basically, of course, it was an attraction for other countries to be there because it's an opportunity to have a direct contact with Western leaders, because it provides some kind of informal opportunity to meet with individuals. I mean, without having a summit or a formal invitation, it's a quite informal framework to meet others and to exchange views. To so it has become a very important aspect of the Western, I would say, economic world. Now, we see now that the rest of the world is hesitant to get closer to the West. Because, first of all, the West is not doing as well as it should or could. And there are political implications of that. And more, we have discussed that many times. Of course, we have discussed that more at strategic and probably even military level. We have seen that with the conflict in the Middle East and, of course, the one in the Ukraine. But it shows that the divide between what the Americans call the Northern Hemisphere and the rest of the world grows. And this discrepancy is, in fact, exemplified, not exemplified, but illustrated by the St. Petersburg Forum, because then you have somehow let's say, the counterpart of the WEF on the rest of the world side, if I can put it that way. And the problem here is that, as I have said, people in the rest of the world note, observe that the West is not going well, but this has also implication on their own relationship with the West. We have seen that, in particular, with the Ukraine, as the US. And other countries, I mean, some Western countries as well, but mainly the US was trying to pressure countries of the rest of the world to join the West in the struggle against Russia. And it's not just about having political declaration, it's also about having economic action, I mean, sanction, taking part to sanctions and all that. And of course, for the US, they probably can afford to have to sanction Russia and to cut some aspect of the economy, or let's say to change supplier, if I can put it that way. The same happens probably to Europe, even if we see that for some countries such as Germany, changing supplier has a cost and has an impact on the whole economy. But somehow, probably the West has this ability and the some kind of flexibility to change partners and suppliers. But this is not the case for other countries, and especially in Africa, for instance. I spent a lot of years in Africa, and I know that you have economies that are improving, that are expanding, that are evolving, but they are still very fragile, and they are still very dependent on the West for support, financial support, and so on and so forth. As a result, when you start pressuring these countries and try to have them on board when you take sanctions, this may have different other implications for them as implication for us. You know, I come from a country which is considered as a rich country, I mean, Switzerland. And of course, Switzerland has been the country that has applied the most sanctions. Until October 2022, Switzerland was the first country to sanction Russia. But we didn't really suffer from that because, of course, we have the ability or the financial means and so on, probably to cope with the drawbacks of having such sanctions. But it may not be the case for countries such as Burkina Faso or other countries that depend on Russian supply, let's say for wheat, for instance, grain, and so on, that Russia can provide at a very affordable price. But, and that may be below the market price, by the way. And African countries don't want to lose this kind of supplier, because when you start sanctioning such a supplier, then you may have significant consequence on your own economy. And you may not have the flexibility that the Western countries do have. And several leaders of especially African countries complained about the consistent effort of the West to pressure them in applying sanctions to Russia, and therefore they feel blackmailed somehow. And when you start blackmailing people, don't expect them to consider you as a friend, as fundamentally. And that's exactly what happens. I mean, that was the West had some reasons. It's not very clear to me which ones, but they had some reasons to fight against Russia. But for the rest of the world, these reasons are not really concrete, may not be as apparent or so. So they don't feel like joining a fight in which they have nothing at stake, and they have only to lose. In fact, they have nothing to gain from this conflict or from joining this conflict. And in addition to that, we have, when I talked about blackmail, you have in effect this idea of blackmail, because most countries today, and that's still the case for about 80% of worldwide trade, 80% of that trade use the dollar, which is, for many countries, this is their reserve currency, and at the same time the main trade currency, and incidentally this is the main currency of the country that is ready to blackmail others so that they follow their own policy. As a result, people understand that being with the West now start to be sometimes toxic, because it may have implications on your own conduct of your own foreign policy. I mean, African countries have a legitimate right to have their own foreign policy, and they don't want anybody to dictate to them what they have to decide, what they have to say, and so on and so forth. And if you don't want, then they would probably sanction you because you are using the dollar, because using the dollar for transaction is already a reason for, or let's say, a leverage to sanction you. So you are under constant the constant threat of blackmail. And I don't think that international relations work that way or should work that way. But that's the way it works in the last 40 years or so. I would say more since the beginning of the 2000s, the year 2000. Before, it was probably less so. But since 2000, as the US was involved in all these conflict and war against terror and so on, they tried to have to gather some kind of unity behind them, and they started to use the currency. They weaponized their currency, in fact. That's basically what Vladimir Putin used to say during this interview with Tucker Carlson. And that's perfectly true. And this weaponization has a price. So we see now this divide growing. And this divide has got a new dimension, because the West noticed, especially in the last 2 years during this Ukraine conflict, that the West has noticed that they are not as strong as they thought they were. And we see that it's not just about the trade with natural gas or oil with Russia, but because the West has somehow associated the fight against Russia with the fight against China. Now, the effect of this Western posture has led to the buildup of a Eurasian bloc, so to say. And now the West is facing this bloc. But if you look at the pattern of the international trade, you will say that basically everything comes to and comes from that Eurasian bloc. And even when you start to sanction China, I mean, if you look at commodities, if you start to sanction oil, or you start to act or to fight against, let's say, Russian oil products and so on, you will have suddenly an international impact. The same when you start sanctioning China for microchips or whatever, you will have very quickly an impact on international trade, because basically, even if you want to say, okay, I don't import Chinese EVs, or I would put very high tariffs on these imports, but if you do so, and you, for instance, you say, oh, I stop to import microchips or whatever, you will see that it very quickly impact on your own economy, because you are using, even if you manufacture vehicles like EV, for instance, you use Chinese microchips to build your own EVs. So when you start sanctioning these microchips, then it means that your own vehicles will become extremely expensive. And regardless of the tariffs you have imposed on the Chinese EVs, your own products will not be competitive, because of the content of your car still depends on China. Meaning that, in fact, trying this kind of, I mean, using economy as a way of waging war is in fact detrimental to everybody, and probably especially detrimental to the West, because the Western economies, and that applies primarily to the US economy, but it applies to the European economy as well. The West tends to have their economy based on financial engineering and no longer on industrial engineering, meaning that we tend to have outsourced our production capabilities to China, to India, and to other countries in the world, meaning that if at one point we would like to redirect our economy and trying to be more based on production capabilities, we will not be able to do that because we are no longer competitive. It's and that's exactly the problem the US, for instance, has with the EVs. I'm not able to assess which car is better than others, but the fact of the matter is that US EVs are much more expensive than Chinese EVs. As a result, that's just an example, but if we try to produce anything else, we will not be competitive. And so we still need to have components that come from India, China, and so on. If you start sanctioning these countries because they don't comply with your own foreign policy and so on, these guys will say, well, guy, we are not trading with you anymore. We are able to produce our own stuff, and it's cheaper. We can sell that to the rest of the world. You know, even the Germans, I mean, now they have to produce their own BMWs and Mercedes. They have to produce them in China, because even Ferrari, because this becomes so expensive to produce in Europe. So meaning that somehow we are condemned to work together, to cooperate, and fighting and using economy as a tool of war, I think is a totally wrong idea, especially coming from countries that have limited capabilities to compete. You know, in addition to that, and that's something that we now I'm talking mostly about China. But in reality, what we are witnessing now by isolating Russia, we are seeing Russia building up its own production capabilities with the help of China, of course. But we can see a move towards improvement of their own industrial production, meaning that in a few decades from now, we'll see not just China as a competitor, but also Russia as a competitor. And I don't even mention here India and so on, because India, as of now, is not subject to the same pressure, or this is not the subject of the same conflict. But imagine the situation in 20 or 30 years from now. Everything that will be produced in the world will come from that part of the world. I mean, Russia, China, India. And I'm not even mentioning countries such as Vietnam, Indonesia, and so on, who have extraordinary capabilities, production capabilities at very low price. I mean, they are very competitive. They provide good work at a very affordable price. As a result, this is a very bad idea from the West trying to exclude these countries from the international trade, to exert pressure on them in order to make them, to force them to be our allies. I think it's a terrible mistake, because the center of gravity, I mean, you know, just after World War II, and even, I mean, in the first half of the second, the 20th century, the center of gravity of economic activities on the world were definitely in the West, first in Europe, then in the United States, and that lasted probably up to the mid 70s and probably a little bit later. But basically, that was the center of gravity of what happened in the world. And that gave, of course, the West some political leverage as well, because they had basically this economic power, this industrial power, and that gave them the ability to use this considerable power to as instrument for their own foreign policy. But slowly we are seeing exactly the opposite happening, that the rest of the world that used to be excluded from the center of gravity is becoming slowly the center of gravity. As a result, we'll see that even things that are still centered, I mean, Western centered, such as, for instance, financial relations, and the yes, currency, I mean, not currency, but the financial economy, if you want, trade and so on, still is not trade, but financial activities, banking activities, and so on, is still centered in the West. But slowly we see, and we saw that already with this idea of expelling Russia from SWIFT and so on, and seeing Russia joining China. We see that slowly this has an impact on the behavior of the rest of the world, because China, as an example, they are using their own SWIFT system, the CIPS. But this system is still working in about 180 countries or so. So meaning that if you want to isolate these guys, I mean, the rest of the world will say, well, why should we still stick to the system monitored by the West, which could be weaponized at every moment or instrumentalized to pressure us, better joining the Chinese system. And that's what we are slowly witnessing today. It's a shift on the center of gravity of financial activities from the West towards the East, meaning that the divide that we are seeing when we address again the Russian conflict, the Palestinian conflict, and so on, this is, I would say, the military side of it. But in the background, there is a much more deeper shift that is happening. And this is linked to the growing lack of trust in the West, the growing sense that the West is behaving just for its own interest and not for the interests of the rest of the world. And more and more people lose their interest for the West. And we see that perfectly. Again, I'm talking about Africa because it's a continent I know well because I lived there. But we see exactly what happened in Northern Africa as to the foreign military presence, that Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso kicked the French out of the country. Even Niger kicked the US out of the country after years of cooperation, because they see that it leads nowhere. And in fact, they are better off to have other partners that will probably help them to develop. You know, it's interesting to see that when the West, I mean, Western companies, French companies also, go in African country and try to help developing economic activity. In fact, they will build a production plant, and in order to be able to outsource some production, and so that you will produce French cars or closes or whatever for the French market. And it's just a way of saving money. And you will have a Western investment, but this investment, the return on investment, goes almost directly to the West. When you look at the Chinese approach, for instance, they don't start building factories. They start building infrastructure. They build roads. They build railroads. They build all that. That probably they may use for better trade with these countries at a later stage. But now if you look at these investments from an African perspective, the Africans say, well, I don't know, if the Chinese probably are looking for serving their own interests, which is fine. But at the same time, by building roads and infrastructure in my country, they are helping my country to develop. And not just for the sake of China, but for the sake of my population. And so it's a totally different approach to development that China has. I worked in two countries, namely Kenya and Sudan. When I was there, these two countries were strong points of the Chinese presence and assistance in Africa. In Sudan, the Chinese were doing big infrastructure works, especially building the dam on the Nile River. And in Kenya, when I was there, China was building highways and the railway road between Mombasa and Nairobi, as an example, among others. But the interesting thing is that in those two countries that were very much the places where China was present, I mean, you knew that Chinese were present, but you never saw a Chinese anywhere. They were just working, building what they were supposed to do, and period. They were not present in the politics, in the local politics. They were not, I mean, when you went on the street and so on, you never saw a Chinese. They were on where they had to be, but not in the rest. And after the work was done, they just left and went. So, and that means from when you take the standpoint of the Africans, that means that Chinese came, helped us. We had a contract. They made what they were supposed to do, but they didn't try to influence, to interfere, to be within our own economic system or the politics and advising and criticizing and trying to influence and so on. They just came, they've done their jobs, and they went. And that's, in fact, that's the way the rest of the world would like to have in terms of relations. They understand that they don't have the capacities that the West has or other countries, the rest of the world has. So they are ready to work with us to do, but they don't want us to come and try to interfere with everything that happens in the country, trying to see what's right, what's not, what is good for women, for this, for that. And so they don't want that. And this is this approach that the Chinese have on the African continent. I never heard any complaint in Africa about the Chinese presence or the Chinese work or investment or the Chinese in Africa. So we see here two different philosophies. In terms of approach and cooperation with the rest of the world. And more, I think the rest of the world has understood that the West is just helps just for the sake of the interest of the West, not for the sake of the interest of the people they're supposed to help. So that's, in fact, based on my own experience and what I observed, I could see in Africa and elsewhere. You see, just come to my mind, but when I was in Afghanistan, the Afghan told me the same thing. I mean, More than 85% of the US investment in Afghanistan during the 20 years they were there, more than 85% of this investment came back to the US, because all the work they were doing, like building roads and things like that, this work was done by American companies, not by locals, meaning that what the benefit from the local population was basically nil. They didn't benefit from that. Some people had jobs and jobs with good salaries. But when the Americans left, they just lost their job, period. So, but there was no, the West, when they left Afghanistan, they didn't leave something. I mean, yes, military equipment. But beside this, they didn't really went, they didn't leave infrastructure and things that can help the country to develop and to build up something based on that. It was not the case. They just used to make war to fund their own companies working there and NGOs and so on. When the war was over, all these guys went back in the West and nothing was left in the country. So our approach of development is totally different from the one that these countries expect. And my view is that so far, it's not a surprise if the rest of the world understands that it's not interesting to work with the West, because we are not providing anything, basically. We just provide a temporary support. We help corruption, that's for sure. We are definitely providing this kind of support, but not more. By the way, if you look at what's happening in Ukraine, you have exactly the same thing. The West is providing weapons, helping corruption. But when this war will be over, the legacy of the West will be simply lost, because it's just money. And the legacy will be all the nice properties that Zelensky and others have acquired in the West. That's all. So I think this is the whole approach that needs to be changed. I always said that, based on what I've seen in Africa and so on, that we shouldn't go in these countries just to tell them what they have to do. We should help them to develop. You know, the West, when we developed, I mean, let's assume we have the best system of democracy, the best system of human rights and everything. Nobody helped us to do that. We were able to do that by ourselves. And the other countries are also able to do that by themselves. They don't need a big brother that comes and say, do that, otherwise I don't give you money. This is not how it works. These guys are adults. They know how their society works. And a society has to evolve, let's say, in harmony with its environment. You cannot come and impose a change, a societal change. You can impose the construction of a building, but you cannot impose a societal change, because this happens in the heart of the people. It's not even in the brain, it's in the heart. And what is in the heart makes much more time to change. And they don't expect us to change that. We should help them to find a way to change, but we should not force them to change. I think we have a totally wrong approach with this country. We consider them as underdeveloped, as children, and so on. So we have to tell them everything, and so these guys know perfectly how they are. They know exactly how the society is, how it should be, and where it's heading to. But each society has its own pace, if you want. Some will evolve quickly and some will evolve more slowly, but a society is a society and we should respect that. The problem is the West is not ready to understand that. You know, I always say the West, the democracy in the West has needed 3,000 years to develop. Since the first theory of democracy by the Greeks 3,000 years ago, we tried to develop it. It took 3,000 years to do it in the West, and even not very perfect, because when I see as a Swiss the difference between the Swiss democracy and the French democracy just next door, I could say this is a world of difference, because the French democracy is nothing else as a elective monarchy. You know, you just elect the king. It's the only difference. But it's not a democracy as we understand it, for instance, in Switzerland. The French are happy with that. That's their problem. I mean, I have no problem with that. What I mean is that even in 3,000 years, we didn't come to perfection, but we each country has its own understanding of what democracy is. So how can we expect that these countries, I mean, most of the countries in the third world that became independent in the second half of the 20th century, how can we expect them to have a system that matches what we have in the West, in other countries? I mean, they have to make their own experience, they made their own development, they made, it has to go with education, with di different things, and the society has to evolve naturally. It cannot be done through coercion. Or and that's what we are trying to do. So the today I think the conflict in Ukraine and the conflict in Palestine have just highlighted this the difference that the West has to approach things than the Asian, this Eurasian group has to addresses the problems. And people understand that probably the best friends, or let's say the best allies we can have, are probably in the East and not so much in the West. I think that's, I mean, in a nutshell, that's my perception of how things have evolved in the in these last few months. And that explains a little bit the development and the interests of the BRICS. Because interestingly enough, the BRICS is not a new thing. It's not new. And China has is a big power, but it's not new either. I mean, China has taken a few years, but let's say since about 15 years or so, China is a big important country. It was even before, but let's say economically and so on, it has become a serious competitor to the United States in the last 15 years. And the BRICS existed at that point, but it didn't attract so much attraction, some interest from the rest of the world. But we saw during the Ukrainian crisis, suddenly you have this interest for the BRICS coming from all parts of the world. And even the Palestinian crisis, not even Latin American countries to be suddenly interested for the BRICS. Meaning that there has been a trigger to that interest. And the trigger was the behavior of the West in those crises. So that's my assessment. Because again, the BRICS existed before the Ukraine crisis, and but nobody was very much interested because nobody understood and probably could see the benefit of it. But suddenly this Ukraine crisis highlighted the benefit of being in another kind of structure than the G7 or whatever. And that's exactly what we are witnessing. So it supports this idea that I have explained in my book, The Russian Art of War. This is that the strategic gain of Russia is much bigger than what we are just saying. And not just because of Russia itself, but also because the Western way of handling the crisis has pushed Russia to be closer to China. And those two countries are the two countries that today tend to lead this BRICS initiative and have shown another way of understanding international relations. By the way, we have mentioned that on your channel a couple of times, but we see when we look at the diplomatic activities in the last 2 years, it's fascinating to see that the Western diplomacy is just inexistent. The Western diplomacy for the Ukrainian conflict, I mean the European one, is totally inexistent. We're talking about Antony Blinken, we're talking about these guys from the US, Victoria Nuland, Blinken, and so on. But on the European side, zero. Same thing for the Palestinian conflict. Today, when we are talking about influencing Netanyahu or trying to find a solution or trying to find some kind of way of negotiating, regardless of it, if it's with intelligence services or with diplomats or so on, when we talk about these aspects, the US come at the surface and no, the Europeans. Although the Europeans are geographically closer to Palestine, they are closer to Ukraine. They are next door, basically. But their diplomacy is totally ineffective. Totally ineffective, has no credibility whatsoever. And that's not just the diplomacy of individual countries, but also the diplomacy of the European Union. That means the overhead kind of diplomacy that you may have in Europe. It's totally inexistent. And even Switzerland, who used to have, thanks to its neutrality policy, had a good reputation in terms of diplomatic initiatives and so on, they've lost everything. I mean, Switzerland is no longer credible. We have discussed the issue of the next peace conference, or so-called peace conference, that will take place in Switzerland, in Bürgenstock, in 2 weeks from now or so. Nobody is interested, and everybody doubts that this conference could bring any fruit, meaning that we see that the West has lost all its credibility, and especially Europe. And the US as well, because at the same time, we see that even if we talk about the US diplomacy and the US influence and so on, we see that Netanyahu doesn't react to any request from the US. That when the Ukrainians attack, for instance, early warning radars of the Russians, they do that against the advice of the Americans, meaning that the Americans have absolutely no influence. They have just money. That's the only way to have some kind of influence. But they have absolutely no influence in political terms and so on. And the diplomacy fails. On the other hand, if you look on the other side, you see on the Russian side, on the Chinese, India, Iran even, you have an extraordinary dynamic diplomacy and diplomatic activities that tries to find solution to problems. We have seen, I mean, all the major progress we have seen in diplomatic terms in the past 2 years, and namely, for instance, the reintegration of Iran into the Middle Eastern community, for instance, the relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and all these kind of things. This happened under the hat of this Eurasian diplomacy, the Chinese certainly, but also the Russian one, and so on. So meaning that we see that these countries that have gained credibility in the rest of the world are at the same time these countries who have an active diplomatic activity that helps to establish trust. They are not using diplomacy to blackmail people, but they are using diplomacy to help to soften the relations, to help to smoothing the relationship between countries, as the diplomacy should do. And it's, for me, it's absolutely no wonder why the West is losing the strategic war against both Russia and China. And it will continue that way because they have a totally wrong approach to the problem. They had, in reality, if you look, and I remember when I was in NATO, I wrote that in the report that I wrote, because as you know, NATO has some partnerships with Mediterranean countries. And this is the so-called Mediterranean Dialogue that has NATO between several countries, especially around the Mediterranean. But I tried to explain, I said, you know, NATO, people speak to NATO because they prefer to have NATO as a friend, as NATO as an enemy. But that's the only reason. It's not because they love NATO. It's just because they don't want NATO as an enemy. So basically, what we are seeing in such kind of partnership, it's some kind of what the Americans used to do, this gunboat policy, you know? So if you are not my friend, you are my enemy and I will destroy you. Basically, this is a little bit. And this is interesting because when I was in NATO, I was in charge of the struggle against proliferation of small arms. And I was in NATO just after the Libya disaster. And of course, in and around Libya, you had a huge traffic of weapons from all sorts that were transiting and circulating around Libya and so on. And so I had contact with all these partner countries, I mean, these countries that were partnered to NATO. And of course, since most of them are French-speaking, used to have very good relation. And when we talked in meetings, they tend to say a little bit more than they were supposed to, probably. But they told me exactly what I said. You know, they are with the West because it's better not to be against. That's all. It's not because they consider us as better. It's just because they don't want to antagonize us, period. So we are in a kind of a mafia-like relationship, you know? And you cannot build international relations on that. And I think that's the reason why when the Mali or the Niger and so on, they are looking for a partner, they prefer to go to the Russians, because the Russians are not coming and blackmail people. They don't do that. They're not saying it's either or. They didn't try to manipulate the presidential election as the French did in Niger, for instance. They don't do that, the Russians. So as a result, you trust people, because when you ask for help, they come for helping you, not for helping them. This is the whole thing. So I think what we are seeing will simply is just the beginning of something. I don't know when it will end, but I'm sure we have what we are witnessing today is a dynamics that will develop in the next week, and that will probably increase, since apparently the West is not going on the right path economically and so on. As a result, the West may not be so attractive as it used to be in the past half century or so. And probably the African countries, again, that might apply to other countries as well, but I know the Africans are a little bit better than the others. But I would say that probably the Africans may consider the Eurasian bloc more attractive than the Western one.